Lord, through your word and your spirit, speak to us now, ancient truths, that we may share in your glory. May the words of my lips and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable and pleasing in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our blessed Redeemer. Amen. Well, welcome on this Memorial Day weekend. I'm Chris Ian, the senior pastor of the Hastings United Methodist Church. There's a proclamation that President Obama put out for Memorial Day. In part, it reads, "Our nation endures and thrives because of the devotion of our men and women in uniform who from generation to generation carry the burden of freedom. Our job is to remember their sacrifice." Why is it important to remember? Why is it important to know your history? World history, national history, church history, family history. I could think of three reasons off the top of my head. Number one, you can better understand today if you understand what happened in the past. You can understand why people act the way that they act, why they're upset about the things that they're upset about, why they feel so strongly about certain things, if you understand the history. Number two, the history can be a warning. It can warn us of things that we don't want to do. That there have been failings in the human race. We've made poor choices at certain times. And by remembering those mistakes, we can lessen the chance that we'll repeat them ourselves and have to pay a similar price. And number three, we can be inspired by the past. By remembering the past and those who acted with virtue, with courage, they can inspire us to act the same way when we go through difficulties and trials like they did. Because it's Memorial Day, let me start with a history lesson. What was the first war that the United States fought after the Revolutionary War? I think the War of 1812? Nope. Quasi-war with France? Nope. Nope. The Barbary War. It was a Barbary War with four Muslim countries on the North Africa that were part of the Ottoman Empire, and the way that they funded their government was through piracy. And so what they would do is they would attack with small, swift gunboats, merchant ships that usually didn't have a lot of defensive protection. They would take the supplies that are on those ships, sell them. They would take the crews back to fortified cities, and they would hold them as ransom until the companies that those merchantmen worked for would pay a ransom. And then where the big money came is when they did that often enough, they would go to individual countries and they would say, if you'd like us to stop attacking your merchant ships, all you have to do is pay us a tribute every year. The tribute was always carefully calculated to be less than it would cost to go to war, and we won't attack your merchant ships. Every single seafaring nation in Europe paid that tribute. Even England, that had the largest, most powerful navy. Along comes the United States, and we have a president, Thomas Jefferson. We have hundreds of merchant ships that have been attacked by these Barbary pirates. We have hundreds of U.S. sailors sitting, rotting in dungeons. And the emissary from these nations shows up and said, all you have to do is pay a tribute to us and we'll stop attacking U.S. shipping. And Jefferson very famously says, we will spend millions on defense, but we will not spend one penny on tribute. So when you hear in the news these days, we do not negotiate with terrorists, that policy goes all the way back to Thomas Jefferson. By saying that, the Barbary pirates step up the attacks on U.S. shipping. Now, the U.S. had dismantled its navy after the Revolutionary War, so we had to rapidly begin to rebuild some ships, one of which you can still visit in Boston Harbor, the Constitution. They were all frigates, which are small, fast, seafaring ships. And as soon as they were made, they got sent over to North Africa. And they picked one country they were going to embargo. We were going to make our point with one country, and that was Tripoli. Unfortunately, for 3 years, Jefferson couldn't get a ship's captain to attack Tripoli because they had huge guns in their fort. And so they kept outside the gun range, and Jefferson, like Lincoln during the Civil War, just got so frustrated that he couldn't find somebody to take on these Barbary pirates. Until a guy named Preble comes along. Preble is this hothead from Massachusetts. He's a great seaman, and he becomes what will be the father of the United States Navy. And whereas everything had been kind of lax before, Preble is two tasks. He said, I want my ship ready to go into action at a moment's notice all the time. Every day, every minute of every day. So he begins to train his crew. He's given command of the Constitution. The Constitution goes over. Now he's the junior officer. He's with another ship. They're going across the Atlantic. They get caught in a hurricane. They get separated. As the junior officer, he's supposed to go and find the senior officer and the flagship, but he doesn't. He goes over to Africa by himself. Now we're starting to see a personality here. He gets over to North Africa off of Tripoli, and the first thing he does is attack the city. These huge guns are blowing away, and he doesn't care. He and the Philadelphia are going back and forth, and then disaster strikes. The Philadelphia runs aground on a sandbar that they didn't know existed there. So all these gunboats come out and surround the Philadelphia like dogs surrounding a wounded water buffalo. And they sit just outside the Philadelphia's gun range. But this is bad, because if those pirates get a hold of a ship as powerful as the Philadelphia, the last 3 years have been for nothing. So Preble gets six junior officers aged 15 to 30. These are called Preble's boys. He grew up in a hurry and back in colonial New Deers, 15 years old. They get on a little boat late at night. They go over, and at great danger to themselves, six people die during this mission. They blow up the Philadelphia. And then Preble begins to attack the city again. The other thing that Preble had done is he had landed a guy named Lieutenant Eaton, who's a part of new officer in the newly formed United States Marine Corps. And he is fighting his way across the north shore of Africa. He takes a large city in Tunis. Little small band of Marines, and then he's got these mercenaries that he's hired. And they take this city, and now they've got a pincer going on Tripoli, and the Pasha, the leader of Tripoli, you've heard the Marine Corps hymn, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of where? That's where this comes from. This pincher taking place, the Pasha of Tripoli contacts Preble and says, I'd like to talk. And so they sue for peace, they surrender, they release all hostages from the United States, not the other hostages from Europe that are still paying tribute, and they make an agreement that the United States never in the future will have to pay tribute. And after we sign that agreement with Tripoli, three other of those nations contact the United States, we'd like to talk. And they make agreements that we don't have to pay tribute to them either. On Memorial Day, we remember those six people that went over there and died blowing up the Philadelphia and all the other people that were involved with setting that precedent, a very important precedent for our country. established by Thomas Jefferson. We don't negotiate and won't be held hostage by people who are trying to blackmail us. I think that fits all of the different criteria of what we get from history. It tells us more of why we act today in relationship with other countries that are trying to blackmail us. It's a warning to us about not letting down your guard. And it's inspiring to hear about men and women who acted so faithfully and selflessly in the defense of our freedom. But history isn't just valuable from a U.S. history standpoint. If you go back into the Old Testament to Deuteronomy, the 9th chapter, verse 7, as Moses is organizing the Hebrew people to establish their nation, one of the things that he says, and this is something that you'll hear in Jewish synagogues today, remember, don't ever forget. Now, we think that they're talking about the Holocaust. It's actually a part of the faith. But what's really interesting about the text, if you keep going, Moses said, remember, don't ever forget how you made the Lord your God furious in the wilderness. Remember when you failed. This is a critical part of the Judeo-Christian faith. If you compare other sacred texts to the Judeo-Christian sacred texts, one of the things you'll be amazed about is how open the scriptures are about our failings. Our spiritual leaders are shown with all of their warts. And this is on purpose. There's always a human tendency to whitewash history. But that serves no purpose. If we're trying to learn from our mistakes, we need to also remember when, rather than acting with courage, we act with cowardice. Rather than doing the right thing, we did the wrong thing. Rather than sacrificing, we acted selfishly. And so our scriptures go a long way to try to remember the stupid things that human beings can do, as well as the smart things that we can do. That's true for today. The church plays a very important role in remembering both the inspiring and the embarrassing, not only within church history, but history in general. I remember one of the young people in our church came up to me, and it was Will Sorg, and he was doing a paper at school, and he said, Pastor Chris, did you know that one time Hastings had an African-American church? And I said, no, I did not know that. He said, yep. There were a group of former slaves that had come up the river, and they had established an African-American church kind of down where Mississippi Terrace is located. And I said, well, what happened to the church? Somebody burned it down. We just sat there looking at each other. He showed me the Hastings Gazette article that it was written about. They believe that two men went in there at night and put some type of flammable liquid all over the floor, and they burned up the church. And the congregation just kind of quietly went away. That's embarrassing and humiliating. That's not the kind of thing you want to remember. You want to remember the good things that you did. But you want to know something? We're better people, we're good people, if we remember that those kind of things happen, sometimes even in our own backyard. And the reason that we want to remember that, like Moses' logic, is if we remember those things, then maybe we won't ever do those things. And they won't happen again. So part of remembering is to remember the failures, but also remember those times when God has been faithful. And that's what the Hebrews text was all about. In verse 32, it said, but remember the earlier days after you saw the light. Remember how you stood your ground while you were suffering from enormous amount of pressure? Sometimes you were exposed to insults and abuse. Other times you became partners with those who treated you that way. Remember how you even showed sympathy toward people in prison and accepted the confiscation of your possessions with joy because you knew that you had better, more lasting possessions. Don't throw away your confidence. It brings great reward. You need to endure and remember so that you can receive the promises after you do God's will. Part of the reason that we remember is to remember how God has been faithful in the past. That gives us confidence that God will be faithful today and in the future. The church plays an important role in remembering faithfulness. Every year, at least once a year, I tell you the story of this congregation and how it was started by very simple pioneers that were coming into Hastings and believed there needed to be a house of prayer and worship in Hastings. And so they started a little meeting house down by the river. It's over 150 years ago. They quickly outgrew that little modest building, so they built another building. And then when they outgrew that, they built another building, which you can still see on 8th Street in Vermilion, 61. And then when that building got to the point where there were arms and legs sticking out the windows and the doors, a faithful member of the church said, "Hey, let me give you some farmland on this piece of property, and why don't you build a church over here?" We've never been a wealthy church. We've never had some corporate tycoon that's writing out a check. It's always been people just like you and me pooling our resources together in order to take the next step of faithfulness. And after that was established and you outgrew that, then you built the addition and the sanctuary that you're now in. Remember last week I was saying the United Methodist Church and all mainline churches in Minnesota are in decline. In fact, the church in general is in decline around the country, but you're not. You've been growing for years. Why is that? I'm inspired by the people that passed the flag of faith to us, who have continued to always do the thing that was necessary in order to fulfill our mission to make disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world. Good for you. We're now holding the flag, but we can be inspired by the past. We make a big mistake when we don't remember what's happened in the past. And unfortunately, sometimes it takes discipline to remember. And we'd rather sleep. We'd rather go do something else. We'd rather watch TV. And the problem with that, there's not anything wrong with those particular things, is if we're not placing ourselves in a place that's remembering, we begin to forget. If you don't have storytellers within your own family, you can begin to forget the history and the wisdom that's being passed on in your family and the inspirational stories of the past. And sometimes they get around and the stories that they're telling are about when Uncle Chucky did something criminal when he was 18 years old and everybody's laughing about it and you're not thinking about the grandkids that are watching all that, who will one day be 16, 17, 18 themselves and want to top Uncle Chucky. It's something to think about. What stories are being said at your dinner table? How is the family history being remembered? Both the good and the bad, the lessons that we've learned from our failures. About this time of year, Memorial Day, I always begin to think about my dad and boats. That could be a book, my dad and boats. He didn't have a lot of money. He worked for the power company. We were a single income household, but he thought, we live in White Bear Lake, we ought to have a boat. So he went and he bought this old fiberglass boat. The thing weighed a ton. And the only motor he could get was a 1950-something Evinrude. You know, a 1950s, a 35-horse motor now is about this big. That 35-horse motor was about the size of a small car today. We used to dread having to put it on the back of this boat. I had two guys that I'd hung out with on my street, Oak Street, Greg Dietrich, Greggy D, and Eric Spreeman, the Big E. We called him the Big E because he was big. He's really big, big guy. I remember my dad once teaching Eric and Greg and me a football move. He just got home, he had his tie on, and he had his glasses on, his white shirt. He said, no, you guys, you don't do that. We're in the front yard, and he takes takes the snap. He fakes like this, and he didn't know Eric was standing there. Anyway, he turned. He hit Eric, and I remember my dad landing on the ground. He's a big guy. His glasses were all cocky like this, and he's bleeding down the temple. And Eric had not moved a millimeter. He just said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Nee." Well, my dad heard that Eric didn't know how to water ski, and we had a boat. And for some reason, Eric's dad wasn't really involved with his life. So he said, "Go down, get Eric, get Greggy D. We're going to teach Eric how to water ski today." So we went down to the White Bear Lake, and we got into the boat. It was a beautiful, sunny day. Unfortunately, that meant there were a lot of other people there fishing and watching this scene. And we went to a side of Manitou Island where it was pretty shallow. And my dad got the boat out and put the rope out, and we got Eric into the skis. That was no small feat. And so Eric's in the skis, and Greg's in the boat. He's supposed to be the spotter, and my dad's standing there in the boat, and the skis are going back and forth, and my job is to hold Eric. And it was like, I don't care what age you are, that's an embarrassing thing to do. And I'm holding Eric, and this is before there was a word called moobs, but I remember watching and I'm seeing this water kind of floating around, thinking Eric has, like, wow, you know, that's really crazy. And he's holding on to the rope, and my dad says, "Now, Eric, when you're ready, say, hit it." So Eric's back there, and we're trying to time the skis because they're going all over the place. And finally, we get him kind of straight, and he goes, "Hit it, Mr. Neen." And so my dad throws down the throttle of Super Pig. That's what we called the boat, Super Pig. And rather than the boat launching forward, it just began to go down in the water. I remember the prop is going, and it's going, and it's just not. And Eric is just standing there in the water. And Eric realized, "We're not going anyplace," and you could have played a guitar string. It was like so tight, and Eric lets go of the rope. And it goes launching, and my dad goes flying into the back of the boat. And all I see the feet of my dad, and he's getting up. And of course, now the boat's really going down the lake. He fights his way up, and he gets the throttle. He fights it back, comes back, and sees if we're okay. And Eric says, "Sorry, Mr. Neen." And I'm going, "Yeah." But when I remember stories like that, I remember the faithfulness of my dad and how a time when dads and moms, you just come home and there was a lot of time to spend with your kids, not only your kids, but the neighborhood kids, and you'd be coaching ball teams. I want to honor him for the choices that he was making in his life. And by telling that, I want my grandkids to know what kind, or his grandkids, my kids, to know what kind of grandpa they had. The most unusual grandpa. What are the stories that you can tell this Memorial Weekend? What are the things that you can remember about growing up that you can honor your parents, your grandparents? What's part of the legacy, the lessons that you've learned? Not just the successes. Sometimes say to your kids, "I remember when I did that," something really dumb like that. It's in the telling of those stories and remembering that we grow wiser as a people. We grow more mature as individuals. You know that I like Frederick Buechner, and I want to end with a devotional that he wrote about remembering. As I'm saying this, you can think about Jesus Christ in your life. You can be thinking about a loved one that's passed away recently. I think whoever you're thinking about, the point that he's making about the importance of remembering will be true. Buechner says, "Remember me. When you remember me, it means that you have carried something of who I am with you. That I have left some mark of who I am on who you are. It means that you can summon me back to your mind, even though countless years and miles may stand between us. It means that if we meet again, you will know me. It means that even after I die, you can still see my face and hear my voice and speak to me in your heart. For as long as you remember me, I am never entirely lost. Amen.